Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
And now our feature presentation.
Award season is nearly done. With the BAFTAs, Golden Globes, and Screen Actors Guild Awards in the rearview, one last ceremony, and perhaps the most famous, remains. That's the Academy Awards, or the Oscars, as they're commonly known.
May I have the envelope, please?
And the Oscar for Best Picture is presented to...
And the Oscar goes 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 to...
Today, the 1A Movie Club is examining the cultural significance of the film's biggest night. We asked you if awards play a big role in what movies you decide to watch, and one of you said that critics' reviews were more valuable than awards. In an era where most viewers can read film reviews online, how much do awards matter? Especially in the age of streaming, how can awards influence a movie's commercial success? I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We'll be back with more in a moment.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest-growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
All right, let's get into it. Joining us from Los Angeles is 1A Entertainment correspondent and film reporter, John Horn. John, it's always great to talk to you.
Always my pleasure, Jen.
And with us as well is Jacqueline Coley. She's an awards editor at Rotten Tomatoes and a frequent contributor to the 1A Movie Club. Jacqueline, welcome back.
So glad to be back.
Okay, so before we dive in, I want to hear who you're rooting for the Oscars' most coveted prize, Best Picture. John?
Rooting for or will win? I'm rooting for Poor Things or Past Lives, but nothing's going to beat Oppenheimer.
Jacqueline, what do you think?
I'm rooting for Oppenheimer, and I think it's going to win. I've kind of loved this movie since it came out, but I will say my dark horse won that if there was a perfect world, we could split it in half, it would go to Poor Things.
Okay, now Oscar viewership has gone up for the past 2 years after reaching a record low of 10.4 million viewers in 2021, but it's been a decade since the awards attracted more than 40 million viewers. John, why did we see such a major drop-off in award show viewers during the pandemic?
I mean, I think a couple things. I think one of the things was that pre-pandemic, there were just too many award shows. Golden Globes kind of went away and came back. I also think during the pandemic, people lost, didn't go to movie theaters anymore. So the idea of having a rooting interest in a theatrical release kind of went away. The other thing is the Oscars come pretty late in the calendar. I mean, we're now beginning of March, and we still haven't handed them out. So I think it's a combination of factors. The real issue for the Academy is their contract with ABC runs out in a couple of years, and that is the lifeblood of the Academy. So I don't know if the Oscars will be streaming in the near future, but I think it's a possibility. So all those people who didn't watch before when it was on ABC can now perhaps watch it in the future if it does go to streaming.
Why do you think, Jacqueline, the number of people watching the Oscars has ticked up recently?
I think there's more interest because of the films in general this year. I think award show this year have, for the most part, all performed better than in recent years because the films are more familiar. I mean, Barbenheimer was such an event over the summer. The fact that with at least two of the top 10 films that are nominated for Best Picture, most people have seen at least one or two. I mean, these are not the days where most people had seen all five and they knew exactly which they were rooting for. It's a little bit harder when you have smaller films. I think also films like The Holdovers and Past Lives, which had a sort of huge insurgence on both streaming and folks watching it at home. There's just more familiarity with both these properties, these filmmakers, and they're very interested to see if they'll win.
Well, I wonder if the way we access reviews also changes that relationship a bit, because now it's not just about the professional critiques, it's audience reviews. It's places like Rotten Tomatoes. Jacqueline, how do you think the popularity and accessibility of film critique has changed the role of the Oscars as an arbiter of taste?
I mean, I think there's a lot more, I don't want to coin this term, but niceification. There's a lot more folks that are trying to find their own particular lane when it comes to entertainment. There's less of the monoculture moments of everyone went to the theater to see things like Titanic. This year, we did have that with Barbie and Oppenheimer. But what we're really seeing is people trying to find a voice online, whether it be on social media, whether it be checking audience verified reviews, or whether it be finding particular voices that they have gravitated towards that are not quote-unquote critics, and saying, okay, this person has similar tastes to myself, and they will help me discover what films I should be watching. And all of this, the sort of underlying heartbeat of it, is the fact that content, as it has shifted away from cinema and artistic endeavor, has made the choices too vast. And most people find it very intimidating to figure out exactly what they want to watch. And so they're trying to get more direction towards that. They will always have critical reviews, but for a lot of people, what the critics like isn't necessarily as specifically geared towards what they like. And that is where you're seeing a lot of more, again, audience-driven, opinion-driven, I would say, folks that are not in the professional space, guiding folks towards their next great watch.
John, I'd love your take as well.
I don't want to knock Rotten Tomatoes. I think that's a great idea, because I think if you reduce movies to a score, it does eliminate, you know, people's desire to find individual critics. I will look at Rotten Tomatoes and scores. I also will look at individual critics. Justin Chang, who was a film critic the LA Times, is now joining the New Yorker, I think is the best critic in the country. So if Justin really likes a movie, I'm going to go see it. If he doesn't like a movie, I'm not going to go see it. Also, you know, word of mouth in person is really important. If somebody comes up to you and says you really have to check out Zone of Interest or a movie that maybe was kind of on your radar but not high on it, and that person has given you good advice in the past, I think that's also a good way to measure it. I mean, I am all for people trying to find critics who match their taste. I think it's hard to find them, but when I go on Rotten Tomatoes, I will look for a movie from particular, you can click on top critics, and I will click on the critics that I like. And if they don't like a movie, even if it has a high Rotten Tomatoes score, I'm probably going to skip it.
Well, you know, last year we were watching the film industry and the various strikes from actors and writers that brought filming to a halt last summer. How do you think the strikes and the conversations we heard from actors and writers maybe are shaping the awards season a little differently, Jacqueline?
Well, I think one sort of notable thing is the film that's in theaters right now was going to be a part of the 2023 conversation. That's Denis Villeneuve's Dune, that was pushed back due to the strikes. I think for a lot of folks, after about July, most of what they were watching was probably in absence of things that they were expecting to watch, because the fall TV slate pretty much didn't happen. And so folks sort of ventured out to the theaters, I think, a little bit more often than they normally would, looking for something new as sort of like that absence of television shows. I don't think we're going to see a huge difference in the film slate until this year. I think this year, for example, when I was at Sundance, you saw a lot more of the studios looking to acquire titles. You were looking at studios that know for a fact due to production schedules that several of their films are going to have to be either pushed out very tightly to make their dates or may have to be pushed even further. So I think the biggest impact will actually be seen in this year's award season, in this year's crop of films. I think it's actually going to be a much smaller year as far as the number of films. And I think it's going to be an interesting year when we get to the end of the year, what 10 films make it to maybe this year's Best Picture race, 2024-25. It might be a very different group of films because, you know, there's just a lot of films that have either exited or are not going to be done in time.
John, I see you nodding along with Jacqueline's assessment there.
I would love to say the Oscars are a meritocracy. They're not. And it often, you know, to the richest people go the spoils in terms of how much you can spend on an Oscar campaign, because tens and tens of millions of dollars are spent. That said, if you look at what happened during this kind of week and a half, 2 weeks, when the Venice, Telluride, and Toronto film festivals happened, the actors were on strike. So they weren't out doing publicity for their films. So the idea that maybe the movie spoke more to critics and Oscar voters and the audience than the actors did, I think is an argument that is not totally invalid. That means that if you don't have a lot of people going out doing Q&As or being on talk shows late at night, the movie itself might have a larger voice than the campaign, because the actors were out during the three big film festivals, Venice, Telluride, and Toronto. And that meant, to my mind, that it was more about the movies and not about the celebrity who was happened to be in it.
Now, the way people watch movies has changed in pretty major ways in recent years. A 2022 survey by data gathering company Statista found that U.S. viewers are split evenly on whether they prefer to stream newly released movies online or watch premieres at a movie theater. So, like, you know, watch it at home or go have, like, the theater event experience. Now, of course, streaming allows individual viewers to find and watch movies that match their tastes, many of which do not get nominated at award shows like the Oscars. But how has this rise in algorithm-driven, ultra-personalized recommendations changed the business of movies? Jacqueline?
I think one thing that we've noticed as, again, what you see on your Netflix queue is not your decision. That is a decision made by an algorithmic taste profile that is built over several years of you watching, is that the window of which films get any attention is narrowing. And there's actually been a flattening out of the types of risks that movie studios and really production companies will make, because they're so trying to cast as wide a net as possible so it reaches the widest net of people when it's put out through these algorithms. It's actually something that I find is sort of being railed against in the newer viewing population. Younger viewers are trying to find things like Discords and discussion groups with other like-minded people to be like, what are you watching? And trying to recreate what we used to consider the water cooler type moments as far as films. And I think that is really the part that I worry about when I look at the future of Hollywood, the idea that the only things getting greenlit are things that reach four quadrants, because we no longer have the home box office of DVD and VHS sales to sort of bolster studios to take bigger risk, because they know they would be able to make more financial sense at home. That is one aspect of streaming that has not yet been solved. It is not making as much economic sense as the previous distribution model as far as everybody that is a part of it. So I hope that as we see things like Oppenheimer had a huge DVD and I would say specialty box set sort of event, whereas that was a film that waited a very long time. It just got on streaming, I think, this past couple weeks. But it had huge at-home VHS sales. I hope that is actually something that maybe continues to go forward as people start to realize that physical media is important, especially as we see more stories of streaming services deleting, refusing to release, and really sort of gaming this system to where you don't even know if these films are going to be a part of that streaming service in 5 or 10 years.
I mean, John, how do films backed by streaming services measure success differently than traditional studios?
It's a very, very closely guarded secret, because they, like Netflix, will release, you know, a top 10 list and some very vague metrics. They know much more closely who watches, how far in they watch, you know, do they come back and watch it again or do they stop? They have lots more information. I mean, this is ultimately what both the actors and the screenwriter strikes were about. Like, how many people are actually watching a show? They don't know. We don't know. Netflix, Amazon, Apple, they know, but they're not really telling us, because A, they have their own systems to measure audience engagement. And B, if they know, then people who have the hit shows that maybe don't know that they have a hit show or movie are going to ask for a lot more money the next time around. I want to say one other thing about the algorithms. Don't trust the algorithms. I was watching the documentary feature 20 Days in Mariupol on Amazon. It ended and they suggested I watch The Big Sick, the Kumail Nanjiani movie next. The only thing they have in common is that they're films. They have nothing thematically in place. So do not trust the algorithms. Work outside of them because sometimes they're going to send you in the wrong direction.
You know, I'm thinking back to the 2022 Oscars. The Apple TV film Coda, directed by Sean Hader, won Best Picture, making it the first time a film released on a streaming service won that top award. Why is winning a major recognition like the Oscar for Best Picture so important for a production house, John?
It's hugely important reputationally because every studio that I've ever visited has their Oscars out in the lobby so you can see them. And while it's just an inert piece of hardware, it actually speaks loudly. And it says, yes, we're a big, bad conglomerate that only cares about making terrible sequels and as much money as possible because we have zero interest in art. But here's our Oscar to prove that we sometimes really care about quality storytelling. And for a filmmaker, seeing that matters a lot. So it does really elevate the studio's presence. It's why Netflix is determined to win a Best Picture Oscar. It kills them that Apple won before they did, because Netflix is obviously very successful, but they also want filmmakers to think, if you come here, you're going to win an award, maybe Best Picture. I hate to bring up his name, but Harvey Weinstein succeeded largely because when he made or acquired a film, he could make that promise and deliver on it. Yes, he's a convicted rapist, but he was able to do something that studios wish they could emulate, which is that they can talk to a filmmaker, say, come here because I'm going to win you an Oscar. And very few studios can do that. And when they do, it matters quite a bit to the studio and to the filmmaker.
Let's head to a quick break with these messages we got from some of you. Daniel emails, I don't understand why people like Poor Things. I thought it was tedious and predictable, beautifully shot, but filled with unlikable characters. The pro-feminist message I'm totally on board with, but I nearly walked out on the movie twice. And Valerie emails, I'm rooting for Lily Gladstone to receive the Best Actress Oscar. It would do my Baha'i heart good to see a Native American receive this acknowledgement. We'll be right back.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's talk about the diversity of this year's Oscars. 7 out of the 20 acting Oscar nominees are people of color and all first-time nominees. That includes Colman Domingo for Rustin, Danielle Brooks for The Color Purple, Lily Gladstone for The Killers of the Flower Moon, Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers, America Ferrera for Barbie, Sterling K. Brown and Jeffrey Wright for American Fiction. Now, let's hear a bit from American Fiction.
Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me, Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me, and he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books,
have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
We got this email from Barbara who says, I think American fiction should win in all of the categories where it's nominated. Such a funny satire that also demonstrates the complexities of black family life. Hashtag Oscars so white meant that more movies by people of color have been nominated. Now it's time that they win. And I want to mention, actor Jeffrey Wright spoke with us just a few months ago, and you can find that conversation and the rest of our movie club series at the1A.org. Jacqueline, how have you seen the Academy shift and move to recognize more diverse talent in recent years?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think the Academy, when they sort of opened up their membership guidelines and invited more people of color into their ranks as a way to diversify its membership, there was a bit of a change in the types of films that were being seen and the types of films that were being nominated. But I think what a bigger shift happened is that, as they say, the farm system changed. You found that movie studios, like I will take American Fiction, for example, that is a film that is produced by MGM or Orion, which is headed by Alana Mayo, from formerly of Michael B. Jordan's production company. And so this is a black woman studio head that, along with the producers of American Fiction, Court Jefferson, and everyone involved in that, shepherded this film. And it's being produced by a studio that then gives it the range and release that allows it to reach a wider audience. That sort of like improving the farm system, in addition to improving the Academy membership. And also, more importantly, I think, as much as we talk about the fact that it's a more diverse slate, we can also say that it is more regionally, globally, an Academy that is not just a reflection of North America or the United States, but really the globe. A lot of the people that they invited to diversify the membership are more global. That is why you see films like Zone of Interest, also Anatomy of a Fall and Past Lives, all of which are foreign language films, being a part of the Best Picture conversation. And I also will say, I think that is also something that you see more in some of the more, like in the Césars, and looking at Venice, there's a lot more of, I think, and I would say less aversion to looking at these stories that are from the black experience, or in this case with Killers of the Flower Moon, that speak to tragedies in Native American history. There's just, I think, a bigger commitment to embracing the cinema of it. And if these stories happen to have diverse casts, that's part of it.
Well, it's been 4 years since the Korean film Parasite made history as the first non-English language movie to win Best Picture at the Oscars. What's the significance about the slow but notable shift in the Academy recognizing more non-English language films, Jacqueline?
I think what is part of it is what Bong Joon-ho said in one of his acceptance speeches that night when Parasite made history. It is the one-inch barrier of subtitles. I think there's been a shift, especially with younger audiences, to embrace subtitled films more often because they're used to social media where subtitles are kind of a part of the culture of watching films on your phone and stuff like that. And then I think there's also, again, it talks about this nicheification. A lot of the horror movies that folks have liked in recent years may have been foreign language films. It starts there, and then they sort of dive into the sort of breadth that is then Korean cinema, and more folks looking to just find a film that speaks to them. And if it happens to speak to them through subtitles, it does not matter as long as it speaks to them.
I know it's hard to predict surprises, but John, what do you think?
I got a couple. I think most prognosticators think the favorite for best actor is Cillian Murphy from Oppenheimer. I think Paul Giamatti from The Holdovers has a very real shot to win in that category. There's a documentary short that I think both of us are big fans of, and that is The Last Repair Shop from Chris Bowers and Ben Proudfoot, about the people who repair musical instruments for the LA Unified School District. It's not favored. I think it could win. But I do think most of the major categories are pretty much set. I don't know that there's going to be any whoppers, but that's why you show up, because you don't know. 20 Days in Mariupol is going to win the documentary feature. I've already put that on my ballot, and it's an important movie because at the time we are considering whether or not we're going to cut off funding for Ukraine. You watch this movie and you can't imagine why anybody would think that was a good idea.
Jacqueline, your thoughts? Any possible surprises?
Well, it's really interesting that he says Cillian Murphy, because I read in Vulture the other day that everyone was like, why were people doubting Cillian Murphy when he's clearly the favorite? So I still think that best actor race is going to be surprising no matter which ends up getting picked, whether it's Paul or Cillian. I'm way more interested in the lead actress race, which I think a lot of people think at this point would likely go to Lily Gladstone, but I am still thinking that it will probably go to Emma Stone because I feel the film is more loved among the Academy members. I think the biggest surprise that I am not predicting yet, but I really think could possibly happen is Past Lives upsetting Anatomy of a Fall. I know this is like so outside of the realm of what most people are saying, but I know how much that movie has sort of spoken to people, and it's had a bit of a resurgence since it went on Netflix internationally. So that's my sort of like upset pick, but I'm pretty well assured about two things, and that is Christopher Nolan's going to win Best Director, and I'm pretty assured that Cord Jefferson is going to get an Oscar on his debut film for Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction. I feel almost positive about those ones.
Okay. Well, a lot of people were upset that Barbie director Greta Gerwig and lead actress Margot Robbie got snubbed in the top directing and acting prizes. But about a third of this year's Oscar nominees are women. The Best Original Screenplay category boasts three women nominees, including Justine Trier for Anatomy of the Fall, Sammy Birch for May December, and Celine Song for Past Lives. Now, John, you spoke with Past Lives director Celine Song earlier about the film. Here's a bit of that conversation.
Part of the film's plot is autobiographical. And I'm wondering, does that mean in a way that you're kind of doubly exposed because people are judging not only the film, but also in a way yourself as that character?
Well, I think that when you're trying to make something that is really personal, it is very vulnerable. But also, I think that there is some total joy in it too, because I get to share something that I personally feel very deeply is what it is like to be a human being. I think that I could find the courage to share the story because I always believe that when I'm making something, the thing that I'm trying to do is to start a conversation with every single audience member, and every single audience member is going to have a different conversation with me. And in that way, making work is about becoming less lonely.
Yeah, Jacqueline, I'm curious whether you think the increase in language, racial, and gender diversity across categories at major award shows, whether it reflects changing values in film more broadly.
Yeah, I really do. I think more importantly now, I think folks are looking not just for exactly what they've had before. I think there is more so than what people talk about superhero fatigue. I think people are looking for a differentiation. There's fatigue of the same. And so by having these stories, like you look at a film like Past Lives, which is so specific, this was her tale, but she made it universally appealing. And the majority of the film is spoken in Korean. That to me speaks to the fact that cinema, as you know, Roger Ebert used to say, is this great empathy machine. And so long as we have filmmakers that are still putting the art first, trying to tell unique stories, and we have incredible producers like Christine Vachon and studios like A24 that allow that vision to be shepherded without the sort of like algorithmic influence to allow the vision to be singular but true, then I think audiences are going to continue to gravitate towards it. And even with films like Barbie and Oppenheimer, say what you will about both of those films being big studio films, all of the filmmakers involved in that spoke to the fact that they had a very specific vision and that they were lucky enough that they eventually, although with Barbie they had to fight a little bit to get there, got the support to allow that vision to be executed in the way that they wanted to, and they didn't have to compromise that vision. And so long as you have faith in these filmmakers, I believe that the audiences will gravitate towards them, and you'll be surprised at what that sort of coalition of people within that audience ends up being.
A recent analysis from Forbes shows that the Oscars bump, which happens when a movie gets a boost in box office sales after getting nominated for an award, isn't as sizable as it used to be. Aside from the blockbuster hits Barbie and Oppenheimer, box office data shows that Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon is the only other Best Picture nominee to earn more than $100 million worldwide, with the others lagging far behind. So, John, a lot of Best Picture nominees are limited releases or they're only shown in select theaters. How does that affect a film's earning potential?
It helps. I mean, if you are Poor Things was one of the, I'm sorry, if you are Past Lives was one of the only art house releases this year that grossed more than $10 million. And that's not a big number. It does help. And it does help, you know, if people are going to not only going to see it on a streaming service, but it does help Celine Song in her career. The thing I wanted to mention, though, is we've talked about how an Oscar helps a studio, how it helps a movie. It also helps the people watching the ceremony. Here's an example. Say you're a young Black girl and you want to become a costume designer and you watch the Oscars every year, and every year it's a white person who wins. So it's understandable that you would say to yourself, you know what? My dream is just a dream. These people don't look like me. And then Ruth Carter wins for Black Panther. She's a Black woman. And this young girl says, you know what? Maybe it is possible. You're a deaf actor who is struggling to find work. And then Troy Kotsur wins supporting actor Oscar for Coda. And you would say to yourself, it's still going to be hard, but it is possible. So we talk a lot about the studios and the filmmakers and the box office and the streaming, but there is a measurable impact on the audience. And just think about Percival Everett. You know, he wrote the book Erasure that American Fiction is based on. I didn't know who Percival Everett was before this movie came out. He's got a new book called James, which is a remake of Huckleberry Finn. I cannot wait to read that book. I would not know who Percival Everett was were it not for American Fiction. So there's a benefit that is not measured in dollars. It's measured in new ways of thinking and seeing the world.
That's 1A Entertainment correspondent John Horn and Jacqueline Coley. She's an awards editor at Rotten Tomatoes. John, Jacqueline, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks. Today's producer was Lauren Hamilton. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR, and our thanks to WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, for hosting us this week. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp. It's easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Therapy can provide the tools and self-awareness to help you learn how to recharge, define your boundaries, and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp Online Therapy. Fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor Framebridge. It's fun to save memories like tickets, souvenirs, or even original artwork. Framebridge offers custom framing for just about anything. It's easy. Order online or go into one of their retail locations for expert help, offering a curated selection of frame styles along with fast service and free shipping. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit Framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store and custom frame just about anything. Framebridge.com.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.